This is my only lecture on chapter 49. It's on muscles, or at least this year it's my only lecture on 49. So one of the things you'll find out about muscles, it's kind of cool, is that they can only do one thing. They can only contract. So they can passively extend, but they only actively contract. Now we've got what's called a musculoskeletal system, and it's based on this idea that muscles can only contract, and therefore muscles must come in what are called antagonistic pairs. And so if you think about it, bones sort of provide the structure, and then the antagonistic muscle pairs move the bones either one way or the other. And so if you actually look at my example here, you'll see that flexing is when muscles bring bones together. Extension is when muscles separate bones. And in my particular example, you'll see that the biceps here, they are flexors. They'll bring the forearm closer, to you. And then the triceps on the other side will extend or move the bone away, okay, move the forearm away. And so you have to have two in order to move both ways, right? One moves one way, one moves the other way. So what you're going to find in the next series, pretty much this whole lecture is, in many ways, it's just an anatomy lecture. I'm going to get deeper and deeper and deeper into the anatomy of the muscle. We're going to start off with, the large muscle. We're going to end up with microscopic views of muscles, okay? So if you can understand the anatomy of the muscle, you pretty much understand, we talked about structure leads to function. If you understand the structure of the muscle, you'll understand the function of the muscle and how it works. So we're going to start off with a muscle itself, which is illustrated. And by the way, I took all these illustrations from a variety of different books that I think do the best job of visually showing how this works. So we begin with the muscle. We start with a muscle, which is really a thousands of muscle cells, okay? And so a muscle, at the end of muscles are tendons, and tendons attach to bones. And then the muscle cells themselves, there's thousands of them that go from one tendon to the next. And all these muscle cells are held together by connective tissue. Now, in my picture, you can see that we're going to take a look at one muscle cell that extends from tendon to tendon. And when we do that, this is, in some books it's called the muscle fiber, in some books it's called the muscle cell, but it's simply a cell. If you go back to chapter 7 and you think about, the classic cell, we think of this spherical thing with a nucleus inside, a bunch of mitochondria, some Golgi apparatus, some endoplasmic reticulum, you know the deal, right? Well, it turns out that not all cells are this classic spherical cell. And they're all, they're all little differences. For instance, a nerve cell. We learned that a nerve cell is really this elongated thing. You got the nerve cell body with the nucleus, but then you got this long thing called the axon, and it's wrapped in this material called the myelin sheath. And so it's kind of different. And then we've also learned that cells can have all kinds of differences. For instance, what's unique about red blood cells? That's kind of interesting, that's not typical. Anyone remember? They don't have any nuclei. So red blood cells have no nuclei, so that's kind of interesting. And in fact, if we look at muscle cells, it turns out that muscle cells have, one muscle cell will have many nuclei. So here's a variation. So muscle cells are not spherical, they're elongated, and there are many nuclei per cell. Also, it's just like any cell, it's surrounded by a cell membrane, a lipid bilayer, right? But we give it a special name. Because it's surrounding a muscle cell, we call it the sarcolemma. If you look at the, if you analyze this from the Greek, sarco is Greek for flesh. And an example, I'm going to say something about this. You've probably seen the word sarcophagus. And you know the word, if you break it down, it's sarco and then phagos. And phago refers to eating, right? We talked about phagocytes, cell eaters, remember that? So sarcophagus really means, we know it's a stone coffin, but what if you just break the word down into Greek, it means flesh eater. And so that's kind of interesting. Okay, so the sarcolemma, which is this, basically it's the plasma membrane, the cell membrane for all muscle cells, it does an interesting thing. It can conduct action potentials. Now you're like, wait a minute, I thought action potentials could only be conducted by nerve cells. Well, yes, they can be conducted by nerve cells, but they can also be conducted by muscle cells. And we'll get into why this is true later, because it's very important for the functioning of muscles to be able to do this. And if you look at my picture here, sort of a cross-section of the inside of a muscle cell, you'll notice that that sarcolemma, that plasma membrane, actually invaginates in and forms this whole series of tubes inside the muscle cell, and these are called the T-tubules. And it allows the action potential to not only move along the outer surface of the muscle cell, but it can dive into those T-tubules and go inside the muscle cell. And that'll become important, as you see, as you'll see later in this lecture. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Just like, you know, all cells have a lipid bilayer, right? Okay, so we're going to dig down into the cell a little bit more. If you take a cross-section of this muscle cell, you will see that there are myofibrils. And so what's a myofibril? Well, it turns out that it's a subcellular structure, which means, you know, there's many of them. It turns out there's many of them inside of a muscle cell. And what's interesting about the myofibrils is that they extend the entire length of the muscle cell. So remember, the muscle cell goes from tendon to tendon, so the myofibrils go tendon to tendon. They extend the entire length of the muscle cell. Now, if you look at my illustration, you'll see this blue thing that sort of surrounds all the myofibrils. And it's basically a modification of the endoplasmic reticulum. You remember that, right? And it's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Sarcoplasmic reticulum. Can you all say that? Right. And its function is a place to store calcium ions. And later in my lecture, you'll see why that's important. But for right now, we need a place to store calcium. Calcium stored in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. In my next slide, we sort of dive down and get a closer look. At the bottom, you will see a myofibril, and I'm zeroing in on one little piece of the myofibril. And if you look, you'll see these vertical lines. They're kind of blue, and they're called Z lines. And it turns out that from one Z line to the next Z line, that is the functional unit of the muscle. It's called the sarcomere. Remember, mere means part. So it's flesh part, or part of the flesh. And it's really the functional unit. So remember from my last slide, the myofibril extends the entire length from tendon to tendon. And there's many of them inside of a muscle cell. And if you look at it, it's made up of a whole bunch of sarcomeres next to one another, all the way from one end to the other. And so what we're going to spend the rest of the lecture on is looking right at the sarcomere and examining what happens at the sarcomere, because that really explains muscle contraction. And it turns out, if you look at this picture, that attached to the Z-line is a protein. And these proteins are called actin. Can you all say it for me? Actin. And so from the Z-lines going each side of the Z-line are these long proteins called actin. And then in the middle, sort of this sarcomere, is another set of proteins called myosin. Can you say that for me? Myosin. And we've actually given these names. The actin is also known as the thin filament, and the myosin is known as the thick filament. And that's because when you look at it under a microscope, actin's fairly thin and myosin's fairly thick. Now, to remember which is which, because, you know, this will be on the test tomorrow. Here's the deal, real easy. The myosin is in the middle of the sarcomere, and myosin starts with M and middle starts with M. That's easy to remember. Actin is on either end. Actin is attached to the Z line, A to Z. Easy to remember. Okay, so actin's attached to the Z line, myosin's in the middle. Now, let's look take a closer look at muscle contraction. In my next slide, you'll see a really big picture of one sarcomere. You can see Z-line to Z-line, and then you see a blow-up of what that looks like. And what's actually kind of cool there is you can see that essentially what happens in muscle contraction is the sarcomere gets shorter. And essentially, the actin and myosin slide past one another, and you can see in the middle picture, there's like, let's say, the sarcomere at its biggest, and then below it, you'll see where it's completely contracted, and the Z-line to Z-line distance is much shorter. Now remember, because you have sarcomeres all lined up along a myofibril, if they all contract together, the Z-line to Z-lines get shorter all along the myofibril. That means the entire myofibril will get shorter. That is what muscle contraction is all the sarcomeres getting shorter at once. So the entire muscle gets shorter at once. Isn't that cool? So then the question you must ask yourself is, well, how does that happen? And that gets us to what's called the sliding filament model of muscle contraction. I'm going to walk you through it right now, and it's actually very easy to understand. It's not complicated. So we start off in my picture. Up on the top, you can see the myosin in the middle, the actin, you know, attached to the Z-lines. And I'm going to take a blow-up of one little section. And then I'm just going to look at one actin and one little piece of a myosin. But you got to remember that in one sarcomere, this is happening thousands of times in one little sarcomere. And there's thousands of sarcomeres. And, you know, so this is going on just millions of times inside muscles. But I'm just going to show you one example. Okay. So the myosin actually has a part of the protein is called the globular head, and it sort of sticks out from the side of the myosin. And what it does is it will bind to the actin. And as it binds to the actin, as soon as it binds to the actin, the globular head will move. It will actually sort of rotate. And as it rotates, because it's grabbed onto the actin, that's what causes the movement, you know, because literally the actin and myosin are sliding past one another, and it's the globular head of the myosin attaching to the actin and then sort of rotating it as it does, it moves the myosin past the actin. Now remember, this is happening all over the place, so it's happening a lot of times. And then it releases, and then what happens is that globular head will extend back out and then glom on to the actin again, pull along, release, extend itself, attach, and it does that multiple times, and that's what muscle contraction is. Now, obviously, in order to do this, you need energy. And the energy that drives this whole process is ATP. And essentially, the way to think of the movement of the globular head, you know how a mousetrap, you can take a mousetrap, and if it's just sitting there, it has no energy in it. But you can add energy to the mousetrap, and you pull the mousetrap back, and you're taking chemical energy from your body, and you're putting it into the elastic potential energy of the mousetrap, and then you set the mousetrap. And it's full of energy, because you wouldn't want to touch that thing, or you could get your finger snapped in it or something. So you know there's lots of energy in it. It's kind of the same way with the myosin globular head. ATP is what sort of sets, quote-unquote, the mousetrap of the globular head, and then it goes through its process of snapping, which is essentially grabbing the actin and then going back to its low-energy state. So if you look at the next slide, you'll see what drives the process. It's ATP hydrolysis, and we remember the word hydro. Hydrolysis, hydro refers to water. Lysis means to split, so hydrolysis is the splitting of water. And ATP, when it's in the presence of water, it will lyse. It will split into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. And when it does that, it releases its energy. So it essentially releases its energy to the myosin globular head, allowing it to essentially you can think of it like cocking. You know, like when you cock a gun or something? It's the same idea, and then you pull the trigger, and then it goes back to its resting state. Then you cock it, and, it's going back and forth. That's essentially what's happening here to the globular head. It's getting cocked, and then it's getting, the energy is then being transferred as it moves along the actin, and then it gets recocked, and then, you know, back and forth. Or if you want to think of it like a mousetrap. Now, what's interesting is this. If you really look at it in great detail, in my next slide, the ATP essentially does this. Let's say when the myosin attaches to the actin, and it will move along the actin, but it's stuck to the actin. It cannot release from the actin until ATP comes along. So ATP is what allows the release of the myosin from the actin, and at the same time sort of cocks the globular head of the myosin back to its high energy state. Now, what happens when you die? Anybody know, is there anything unusual that happens when you die? Yes. You stiffen up. What's that called? Rigor mortis. Why do you think you stiffen up when you die? When things die, based on what you've just learned, why do things stiffen up? Claire? Your body stops producing ATP. Why? Because you're dead. Okay? But what process in our body produces ATP? Cellular respiration. So cellular respiration produces ATP. ATP is used to move muscles. No ATP, you can't release. And so literally, this is what happens. All the millions of myosin heads are locked on to their actin, and they can't release. And so you're just, whatever position you die in over, you know, as your ATP is used up, and I don't know how long it takes. I'm sure you can go on the internet and find out. Maybe an hour, maybe two, I don't know. However long it takes, eventually, once all the ATP is used up, whatever position you're in, you're going to stay in that position. Now, I had a really sort of gruesome example of this when I was in dental school at UCLA, because we had a course called Gross Anatomy. And in that course, what happened was, we dissected a human body for about 6 months. And the very first week, we went into the anatomy lab. There were four people on each cadaver, two on each side, because we're bilaterally symmetrical. And so you go into this stainless steel, you know, the bodies and the cadavers in the stainless steel container, and you open it up, you come up alongside of it, and the very first week, we were supposed to dissect the arm, because it's right there, it's very easy to dissect. And so, of course, the cadaver's arms are at its side, and what you try to do is try to rotate the arm about 90 degrees so you can actually have access to it. And, of course, it doesn't want to, so you kind of twist it, and then it just flips back into place. And then you try it again, and then maybe the whole body starts coming at you, you know, because it's all attached. And then, you know, it's just very, and then your partners are trying to do the same thing on the other side, and it's sort of comic, but it's also sort of gruesome. It's just a weird mixture of, it was just a strange week. I'll never forget that week. And we were all kind of just, this is weird. But eventually what we did is you had to basically do what Alex just mentioned. You got to cut all the tendons around the shoulder and kind of release and relax it, because there's no way you're going to actually rotate it and have it stay there. It's very difficult. Yeah. No, I mean, once you're in rigor mortis, you're in rigor mortis. Yeah. Okay. In my next slide, I know it's kind of weird. Kind of weird. By the way, Gross Anatomy is one of the most interesting courses I ever took. And I would highly recommend, I mean, even though it's kind of gruesome, it's really interesting to see how the human body is, you know, is made. And so I would highly recommend it to anybody. You need to do it in dental school because you're working on the head and neck region, and you need to understand all the muscles and nerves. And so we started just getting good at dissecting in the lower part of the body. but we really had to get what the ultimate purpose was, to understand the head and neck super well. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so you can, I guess you can take it to West Valley. Okay, now here, muscle contraction. I've got an overview. I think it's good to learn things in little pieces, but eventually you have to put it all back together. So in this slide, I put it all back together. 1, 2, 3, 4, you can see all the steps. It's all summarized there. Okay, now, I'm going to get into more detail. And this is actually interesting because I think it was maybe more than 10 years ago, it was quite a while ago, they actually had a question on the AP exam. Basically, it was the question was, describe how muscles contract. And they wanted you to get even to the level of detail that I'm going to give you right now. So it's actually pretty cool. Check it out. So in this picture, you'll see actin. And actin is kind of a helical molecule. It's like two sets of proteins that are wound around one another. And what you'll see if you look on my picture, you'll see that there's these dark spots on each of the myosin, or excuse me, each of the actin. And those are what are called myosin binding sites. So that's where the myosin molecule, the globular head, binds. Well, if you're clever and you're very observant, you'll notice that there's this other structure wound around the actin that covers those myosin binding sites. And that molecule is called tropomyosin. Can everyone say that for me, tropomyosin? Now, what's interesting is that even though you've got ATP, the globular head of the myosin cannot bind if the myosin binding sites are covered like they are right now. And what you'll notice, if you're a good observer, you'll notice that there's some lighter colored, sort of yellowish, molecules that are attached to the tropomyosin, and they are called troponin. Can you say that for me, troponin? And you'll notice that they have a little binding site as well. And what happens here is very, very cool. Calcium will bind to the troponin, and that will cause the tropomyosin to move away from the myosin binding sites on the actin. And now you can have muscular contraction. So you have to have this process. So in order to have muscle contraction, not only do you need ATP, but you also need what? Calcium. Very important, yeah. It depends. We can get into this later, but it's a little more complicated. We can talk about it. On my next slide, what you see here, okay, first of all, we all know that when a nerve comes up against another nerve, there's a little space between the nerves. That's called the synapse. And in order to communicate from nerve to nerve, what needs to be released at the synapse? Neurotransmitters. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of different neurotransmitters that can be released. Now, this is interesting. When a nerve comes from the spine or from the brain and goes to a muscle, the place where the nerve and muscle meet, they don't literally touch either. There's actually a little space between the nerve and the muscle. And it's not called the synapse, it's called the neuromuscular junction. So, and just like the space between nerves, you need a neurotransmitter to go across the neuromuscular junction to communicate from the nerve to the muscle. And that neurotransmitter this is interesting, for all muscles in your body, it's the same neurotransmitter. It is acetylcholine. Can you all say it for me? Acetylcholine. And so it's the communicator. And what it does is very interesting. You get a signal. It comes from let's say your spine, goes out to your to the end of that nerve. Acetylcholine is released. It goes across. It binds to a receptor on the muscle. And remember, the surface of the muscle, is really basically the cell membrane, but we have a special name for it. It's called the sarcolemma. So there's these receptors on the sarcolemma, and those receptors, the acetylcholine binds to those receptors. That causes the opening of sodium channels. Sodium rushes in. That you hit threshold, and then you got yourself an action potential. And once you have an action potential, that action potential will sweep along the surface of the muscle. You're like, wait a minute, this is weird. This is like, you know, kind of like nerves. It is. And that what happens, what's really interesting, is the action potential will sweep along the surface of the muscles, and it will actually go into the muscles through these invaginations of the sarcolemma into what are called the T-tubules. So the action potential actually will be deep inside the muscle itself. Why? What's the function? Well, it turns out that I told you earlier that there's this bag of calcium inside the muscles, and it's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's just a big bag of calcium. The action potential will cause the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium. So now calcium is just flowing all through the muscle cell, and it surrounds the myofibrils, and it's, of course, what we just mentioned in the last slide. It will bind to the troponin, causing the tropomyosin to move away from the myosin binding sites on the actin, and the globular head of the myosin can bind, and there you go. You can have muscle contraction, and as long as there's ATP, this will go on again and again and again, and you'll basically get contraction of the muscle. And essentially, all the sarcomeres will get smaller, and collectively, that means the whole muscle gets shorter. Okay? And that's the process of muscle contraction from start to finish. Pretty cool.